Hello and welcome to the Catbird Speaks, the podcast for the Catbird Seat blog, the White Sox affiliate for the ESPN Sweet Spot Network. I am Matt Adams, and with me today is Nick Schaefer in Manhattan, Alphabet City.
Yeah, that's right. That's right. Well remembered. How are you doing?
Doing well. I'll be up your way in about a month.
Oh, that's right. That's right. So the White Sox are playing a four-game set here against the Yankees the week after my birthday. So I'm still undecided as to how many of those games I'll be at, but I will be at least one.
I am at the moment penciled in for all four. which means they're going to lose all four because I've actually seen the White Sox play at Yankee Stadium. I think I'm up to six times, and they're 0-6.
Oh, okay. Well, maybe I can offset that because I grew up going to a lot of White Sox Yankee games. I was there. I've referenced a few times that 95 doubleheader where Raines and Thomas went back to back off of Jack McDowell in the first inning. There was Cal Eldred's last game pitched in a White Sox uniform in 2000 when they went up 10-2, I think. Eldred left the game with an injury and they held on to win 10-9 after a lengthy rain delay. And then I went to two of the three games in 05. Where they split, they wound up winning 2 out of 3, but that was when that guy fell out of the upper deck and sat on the netting, the mesh over the over home plate at Yankee Stadium for a bit.
Was that Yankee Stadium? I always remember that Fenway thing in my head.
No, it was Yankee Stadium, and we brought White Sox fans to the game the White Sox lost, and our Yankee fan friends to the games the White Sox won. So it was very tactical on our part. Juan Uribe hit like a walk-off triple against like Mariano Rivera because in the 10th.
I really hope it wasn't a walk-off. That'd be some crazy shit.
Oh, sorry. Game winner. Cliff Polite and Neil Cotso weren't in the habit of giving up runs at that point. And it was because Bernie Williams is still playing center for some reason for the Yankees. It was great.
Did Bernie got his day this week, right? I mean, this year, right? Like everybody else through the 90s Yankees teams.
Yeah, I think so. I think so. I remember seeing something like that. He probably insisted on playing guitar or something.
That would make sense.
Oh, man. So, also, if you go to four games in a row, the odds of you seeing John Danks pitch are really high.
Oh, yeah, almost absolute. That was my last game in Anaheim when I went to the series in Anaheim. It was the Danks game. I only went to two of that series, but...
I think you and I saw one of Danks' first games back from his shoulder surgery in Arizona in, like, 2013.
I think that's correct, yeah, because we were kind of obsessing about no speed gun in the stadium.
Yeah, but, like, he and Trevor Cahill were both pitching, and it was just astounding how, like, limp both of their arsenals were. Because then Archie Bradley came on later, and it looked like he was shooting the ball out of a cannon. but we are now recording this Sunday night on the heels of, I believe they just took they just took 2 out of 3 from Seattle in somewhat amusing fashion.
Yes. Some,
although today was, I was trying to segue into the John Danks thing, and that's on the heels of losing 3 out of 4 to the Angels, which I think James covered pretty thoroughly in his morning tens last week. So I think really we're left with these three Mariners games.
Yeah, and the Mariners really tried to give away today's game as well. The only thing, I mean, it's really weird to watch, to have watched this series because the White Sox really socked it up until the Mariners then went and socked it. I mean, it's like looking in a mirror. It was playing against a mirror in many ways.
The Mariners are really like that for the White Sox in a lot of ways. Like, they've been going for it a lot in recent memory, and it's not working. They have a frontline ace who they've largely wasted. They keep throwing resources at hitting, and it doesn't work. None of their
problems.
Yeah, I mean, well, Jose Abreu is the foil there. And, and you know, you've got... They rush their hitting prospects and they all bust. I mean, it's the analogies are creepy. The volume of analogies is unsettling. I think the expectations were higher for Seattle coming into this year because Zips and such liked them so much, but they've been just as incompetent, if not more, than the White Sox this year.
Yeah, I mean, I don't, the expectations were high on the projections, but I mean, we've gone over the whole, like, the overvalue of the park factors that probably plays pretty heavily into why everyone loves the Mariners every year.
Right.
But yeah, I mean, just so similar in scope that it's pretty annoying, and it'll all come full circle when Kenny Williams fills that role as their VP or whatever the hell it is they're trying to fill.
Yeah, I mean, the shakeups, the sort of desperate shakeups, the White Sox almost seem to trigger them because they obviously had the Laffer on Friday behind Sale, and that was just an amazing game all around. That's one of the most fun games of the season, I would say, where it's just, you know, everything seems to work out. Trumbo hit, you know, you run into a Trumbo home run, that'll happen from time to time, but otherwise Sale just continues his fire breathing reign of death on all hitters, and the offense went nuts as well. So that was definitely success. And then Saturday the White Sox had destroyed the Mariners bullpen, which has been an absolute disaster this season. It prompted Rodney getting DFA'd, it prompted Farquhar getting sent to AAA, and it prompted McClendon going to his closer in the seventh, I think, today.
Yeah, Mariners radio was talking about this was the earliest they'd seen him come into a game since, I think they said it was the end of May or something like that.
So, you know, this isn't the first time we've seen the White Sox success inspire panic in an opponent. Like, geez, if we're getting blown up by the White Sox, we gotta fix something. But Jack Z is almost, I mean, Jack Z has to be gone after this year, right?
I mean, I don't know what motivates, in those regards anymore. Sometimes when somebody has enough time to put together a little project and watch it fail, they get fired. But to me, it seems like the workings of the front office, as far as the hiring and firings of the general managers, are largely revisionist for us. There's things that are going on that causes it, and then we get to go and say, well, it was probably because look at this, what happened. But it's very hard to see those coming.
I mean, it's true. So you've got, and they do have, Seattle does have one of the weirder executive situations, I think, across the majors. They, I think, as their ownership is essentially Nintendo, right? I mean, and they have Lincoln in place as sort of the president, the executive, you know, the CEO sort of figure. And so I guess a lot of it's really just left to the whims of that one guy.
I mean, that's another similarity to the White Sox. I mean, it's a board of owners, basically, and Jerry Reinsdorf is the chairman, hence the nickname, the chairman.
Right. So, yeah, the similarities continue. Although, you know, Jack Z's had 7 years now. He's been able to try his hand at top five, top ten draft picks. None of them have worked. He's been given a lot of money. That hasn't worked. His trades have not worked. So I understand that there's more to it than just the GM, but you do wonder how much time he has left. And
yeah, and you know, the layers that they add to these, which plays into the White Sox as well with the whole Han Kenny Williams dynamic, there's no way for us ever to know who to blame as laypersons, you know, sitting on our couches, because we don't know who necessarily pulled what trigger or who talked, you know, Reinsdorf into, you know, loosening the purse strings for certain players. It's tough as a fan who wants to lay blame.
I know, and it's that comes in at a lot of levels of analysis with, like, oh, well, you know, a lot of the time when I'm on Twitter griping about a decision Rob Ventura makes with a pitcher, the easy response is, well, doesn't Don Cooper make those calls, and, you know, and who are we to question Don Cooper? Which, yeah, I agree, Don Cooper is the best, but I do wonder who's making which decision, and therefore, obviously, beyond the fact that we don't even know what information they have, that we
right.
don't, there's also the fact that we don't even know who's making these decisions. I will say that there did seem to be a different type of decision, you know, different types of decisions were getting made once Han was put in charge than the ones when Kenny was the GM. But some of that may have just been forced upon the front office by what was happening on the field. Some of it may have, you never know what ownership's putting their thumb on the scale. So, you know, even when you have something like the Padres, for example, who had such a crazy offseason and then stood pat seemingly suicidally at the trade deadline, and people are laughing at Preller, and I'm just sitting here thinking, like, who knows? His hands, like, Preller may not have any say in the matter, and that's it's got to be a rough working environment. having your name stuck to decisions you didn't make.
It definitely is. I think it's one of those things that you have to be, I guess you could kind of liken it to player defense or team defense. Like, you have all these metrics and, you know, the basic statistics, and they can give you an idea at a glance if, say, you don't have the chance to watch guys play, but you really need to be watching these players play almost every day to have a really good idea of what kind of defensive player they are. And I think it's the same for the GMs and the front office and everything. Like, you have to actually watch the way they're trying to go about things to really know what's going on in
their
head.
At a certain point, too, though, you know, similarly to how for like 1 year to the next, people look at how peripherals for pitching is a better predictor than ERA for future performance, but only up to a certain point. And then after a while, once you have like 8 or 9 years on a guy, ERA is actually a better predictor for that pitcher's future performance, barring some sort of massive change of scenery or circumstances around them, because it captures all of the things that peripherals try to approximate. Like, well, this guy's just better at his sequencing, or this guy's in certain situations, or this guy, you know, gets more infield fly balls than you might expect that isn't captured by a strikeout to walk ratio. And that's, or, you know, like Mark Burley has his oddities that aren't necessarily reflected in his peripherals. And similarly, I think if a GM has been in charge long enough, barring some sort of massive influence of a really meddling owner, at a certain point, all you have is the result, and it's like, okay, well, Jack Z's been in charge for 7 or 8 years, and he's tried a lot of different things, and none of it's working.
Yeah, definitely. Once that sample size grows to a certain point, there's no excuses left.
Do you buy any of this Kenny Williams on the move thing?
I mean, do I buy it as, like, a possibility of happening? Sure. I mean, he was really close. He actually, I think he said he asked for permission to be interviewed last November or December?
By Toronto.
Toronto. So, I mean, it's definitely something that's been considered. It's not unheard of for that to happen. And he's going through all the right channels. I mean, he asked for permission. He wasn't like, it was that weird thing with Dan Duquette where it was all like they were trying to poach him. and that got weird quick. But, you know, Kenny Williams went through the right channels and they shut it down for this year, and maybe next year he asks for permission as soon as the World Series ends or as soon as the Sox season ends and starts doing these interviews.
I like how you act as if the World Series ending is different from when the White Sox.
Well, they're still technically in it, Nick.
I saw a tweet after their win last night. They were, like, 4 games out of the locker, something stupid.
Yeah,
like
4.5. You know, it's angering. It's frustrating in hindsight. Like, I'm no longer able to get frustrated at the current season. I feel like I had to cap that at 2. There was the initial frustration with, wow, I guess this team actually does suck. Mm-hmm. And then that weird, you know, when they ran off a couple of 8-game win streaks and they were just a few games off, and I thought, well, shit, this might happen. And then that was frustrating. But now it's just, you know, it's hindsight frustrating because, look, if they didn't go on any of these terrible skids in the last month where they just looked god-awful, they're still close enough now that just removing those little stupid skids puts them right at the top.
Right, and it wasn't just that, too. It was that there were those months where it was just, this is the worst offense in 15 years or whatever it is. Or not only that, like, none of them can hit and none of them can field. This is just a disaster at every level. And you had, you know, Adam Eaton and Melky Cabrera having what turns out to be, it looks like, aberration, terrible starts to the season. And, you know, you have Gillespie and Beckham at third base for way much, it turns out, way longer, much more rope than they should have gotten, and so on. And, you know, it may turn out that Carlos Sanchez is a viable middle of the road or low end, you know, acceptable starting second baseman. But for about 30, I think like 30 or 40 games, he was hitting like a pitcher. So, like, there was just, it's amazing how many just haymakers this team took. And it's like, and like, you're right. Like you said, it's like, you know, if they just don't spend half their games in Minnesota kicking the ball around the infield, or if, you know, Jeff Samardzija has like a couple more good outings, like they're right there. But okay, so I was just looking at the wild card standings, and so you have the three division leaders, right? You have Toronto, Kansas City, and Houston, and Kansas City and Houston looked very, very strong to win their divisions. And then the Yankees are obviously flipping back and forth with Toronto. Outside of those four teams, without looking at it, do you want to guess how many teams have a positive run differential in the American League?
Is it zero, Nick?
No, it's not zero. It's not zero.
Because that would be really, well, mathematically difficult to pull off.
It's between 0 and 11 is the clue I'll give you.
Yeah, well, thank you for that. I'm going to take a low-end guess and put it at 4.
The correct answer was 2.
Oh, man.
The Angels have fallen below the positive. They're at minus 2. The two teams are having fun with this guessing game. Can you guess who the two teams are? Having already told you it's not the Angels.
Restate who you already eliminated that were the top. It was Toronto.
Toronto, Yankees, Royals, and Astros.
Okay, that's what I thought.
So the four teams that are very, very likely to make the playoffs.
Are the A's still carrying a positive differential?
They are.
Yeah,
and the worst record in the American League.
Yeah, they were the hard luck team all year, and they continue to do it. Billy Bean's got to be some kind of pissed at that.
Yeah, he hasn't had a whole lot of luck on his side.
Let's see. It's certainly not the Twins, because they were awful even when they were good. We go with the Orioles.
You're correct. They're plus 50. Anyway, so yeah, the AL was right there for the taking this year.
The good news is, considering what they've done to get themselves where they're not, like, buried, you know, already counting down elimination numbers, is, you know, we're stuck with a lot of these players. So it's, you know, Melky coming around, Eaton coming around, that's a big deal, even if it doesn't mean anything for 2015.
Yeah, and similarly, you know, I still think, I don't know if, I think you and I are the biggest Alexi fans in the White Sox blog universe, or maybe I'm flattering myself with that, but I do still think he's going to be a fine option at short for next season. I really wasn't expecting Carlos Sanchez to show as much life as he has.
Yeah, I am not necessarily a subscriber to the Carlos Sanchez offensive viability. I buy it at the newsstand regularly at this point, but I am not.
You still get, frustrated shaking out those little subscription cards that are rattled.
Yeah, exactly. But it's better than having my name plastered all over the front of every issue.
Yeah, and accidentally getting delivered to your neighbors. And you have to go, how far can we push this metaphor?
Yeah, I think we're done. he's been impressive. I'm really surprised that he's still kept it to a playable level. And, you know, I know he's hit at every level. And I know he's very young, but there's just something about it. I just don't. At this point, there's so many other pieces to try to worry about that I'm not too worried about second base. I'd be more worried about third base. More worried about, is it worth cutting bait on Adam LaRoche or finding a platoon partner for him? And what are we going to do over right field?
So that's interesting that that third base is more of a concern than second base at this point. I mean, I guess Sanchez's glove is probably better at second than Saladino's is at third. And offensive requirements of third base are higher than
right. And the positional weight there too. I mean, if you can have a plus glove anywhere, you want it in the middle.
Yeah, no, exactly. So, I would have to imagine that. And I guess they came into the season with this plan as well. But going into next year, I guess if you had to say, look, between Sanchez and Saladino, we have somebody we could throw at second, and be okay there.
I don't have. But, I have probably less confidence in Saladino. Well, I mean, I guess I see a lot of people with a similar level of confidence to me. I don't think Saladino is going to be much moving forward.
No, I don't either. But it's just it's incredible, and maybe this is damning with the faintest of praise. But the idea that it took them this long to shuffle around to get somebody who could be serviceable over there, where you know you had Gordon Beckham hitting 150 or whatever.
Is Beckham still on the team?
Yeah, he is, because he played the other day. He got the start, and he was left in to hit in like a high leverage situation. It was crazy. I'm blanking on what the spot was, but there was a close game, and I think Beckham made like the last out or the second to last out or something like that.
So this is part of the reason I want the White Sox to just go ahead and be not in it anymore, because Robin Ventura is managing a certain way, and perhaps he's managing because he's like, well, we're not out of it, which doesn't necessarily make sense towards a lot of his moves, but
right.
It's I kind of want to see, I want them to tip their hand as for what they're looking for 2016, you know what I mean?
Yeah, it's been what's frustrating about, it's one of the many things that's frustrating about this season is this is such this is such a limbo season. It's not clear what the team's trying to accomplish because, I mean, they played themselves in a position by July 31st where they were 2.5 out on the wild card. They were looking great. And there were strengths that you could point to on the team. Like, look, the front of this rotation should be really good. The offense is finally clicking and some of those guys have established track records. So it was understandable at July 31st why they wanted to stand pat. And I think we talked about that at length, but I guess as you approach the waiver deadline, I don't know. It's odd to me that like Soto is still on the team. It's odd to me that Samardzija's still on the team. I mean, most of White Sox Twitter that I see seems to be convinced, hey, they're going to try to re-sign him. This isn't the NBA where you can offer him more money than anybody else just because he's on your team at the end of the season. He's going to be just a free agent. And I've always thought people overrated that whole, well, we get to negotiate with him privately or get him to like us privately before he hits free agency. I thought that would, I feel like that's always vastly overstated.
It might be, but from the position they're in now, it's more show of good faith. And I think that's probably worth a little more than that we traded for him in the last 2 months of his contract in an effort to re-sign him after.
What do you mean show of good faith?
Like, keeping him through this and then trying to re-sign him, it's worth more to the White Sox from that angle than it would be, say, to, like, let's just say the Padres to trade for him in the hopes of signing him for the future.
Well, theoretically, if you wanted to foster goodwill with Samardzija, you'd do him the favor of not having draft pick attached to him by trading him. By hanging on to him, saying, like, look, we have a 2% chance of making the playoffs, like, and we're going to jeopardize a lot of your potential earnings. I don't know. I don't know how much goodwill that'll foster. if my employer's like, I'm going to damage your marketability in the future because I'm really misguided, I'm not really going to care for that employer after that.
It didn't really occur to me that, I mean, that's another reason for him to, that kind of incentivizes him to take the White Sox, whatever they offer, depending obviously on what else gets strewn about from other teams. Real quick, while I have this up, because I looked at it, you were surprised about my concern re Saladino and Sanchez.
Mm-hmm.
Sanchez has an OPS plus of 78, Saladino of 79.
OPS no, their offense is pretty much has been really similar. It's normalized to a really similar place. And you can look at their respective track records versus, you know, how much stock you put in Saladino being 6 feet tall as opposed to 5'7" or whatever it is. Sanchez has a much better prospect pedigree. He's advanced to a younger age. He also has a pretty, I hate looking at this and, cause it's such minor league statistical scouting is the mark of an amateur in a lot of ways, but at every level, Sanchez has taken a long time to adjust, it does make sense. It drives common sense that it's like he gets promoted really at a really young age because he's hitting really well. And then he's facing much more advanced pitching than he's ever seen before. and it takes him a while to adapt. But then once he does, he kind of like figures it out, and then he goes back to his high average ways. And obviously Major League Baseball is a different animal than the minors, but we kind of saw that he's much more comfortable than he was the first month that he was up. And there's, like I said, it's logical that someone would behave that way.
Yeah, I mean, I'm right with you 100% on that.
So, no, I you're probably right. I think Sanchez is
I'll take the 23-year-old plus glove versus the 26-year-old fine glove, you know, as far as who I'm going to be in a more valuable position for that plus glove if I'm going to have to choose a place to worry about, you know, finding some new blood.
Yeah, I'd be interested to see what they can possibly do at third base given how little's available. And that's something I've come back to a few times. I don't know if I've gotten your take on it, and this ties into the Samardzija conversation. And a narrative I've been pushing, or a point that I've been pushing, is that Samardzija doesn't really seem to be what they should be spending their money on. And when you look at what you can convert into solving problems with your money for next season and in the next couple seasons, there's a couple like really good right fielders who are going to corner outfielders who are going to be available this offseason.
Yeah. You got Hayward and Upton and,
there's a couple other, there may be other guys too, but those are the ones I'm primarily thinking of. There aren't really any third basemen, and there's plenty of, you know, mid rotation pitching options that you can conjure up either from within the organization or acquire with money also.
Yeah, it's definitely, Samardzija is not someone that needs to have a lot of money thrown at him. I mean, if they can get him for, you know, a very reasonable rate, I wouldn't be like upset about having him in the rotation. But yeah, I mean, it's not asking a lot to expect Carlos Rodon to take even a small step forward, and a small step forward for him from what he's shown is probably it's playable in the rotation. And then it's not beyond the realm of possibility that we see a similar sort of thing out of Fulmer next year, kind of getting up at some point and taking his bumps.
Yep.
Taking his lumps. And then, of course, there's the long-awaited Eric Johnson, what do you got going on here? So it's that's worth checking out. And I think we talked about before, you know, you can also, if you really want to give Montas a shot, you can do that as well, although they're kind of down on him as a starter.
Do you think – What do you think is going on with Eric Johnson still being in AAA? I mean, it's easy to ask this on the heels of a start where John Danks got clobbered again.
I think you're touching on it. They're not ready to give up on Danks, and what else are you going to do to push it? I mean,
well, I guess, and it's easier said than done. You know, I'm sitting here looking at possibilities, and I'm thinking, well, hey, why don't they see what they can get for Samardzija on a waiver deal, or at least float him through? I don't know if he'd clear. Because he's, I think it'd be pretty easy to put a claim in on him, but to clear the spot, because Danks is obviously under contract for next season, and there is a utility to him, and you know, it's pretty clear what that utility is, but it's utility nonetheless. So it's just odd that we, you know, it's end of August and we still haven't gotten a chance to see Eric Johnson, even in a spot start.
Yeah, that's the curious part, is I feel like if there was another spot start to come up, they would still go to Carroll or something.
Yeah, and they went with Chris Beck earlier in the season. I mean, granted, Johnson's, at that point, they probably didn't want to mess with...
I think it was the turn in the rotation, yeah.
Yeah, and he was going well, and it was still early enough on that it's like, okay, well, let's just let Eric Johnson consolidate and keep his confidence going and keep killing it in AAA for a little bit, but... Montas got the call up for a doubleheader, like significantly later than that. It just seems a little strange.
Well, yeah, I mean, I think the Montas part was like they knew he wasn't going to start, and they didn't want to do that to Johnson. But also, so when the rosters expand here, I would expect to see at least a skipped start or two or something from Rodon. I mean, we've talked about a while back, kind of his innings history, and I could just see kind of why not. Scale him back. Just, you know, you don't have to shut him down, but no need to push it hard at the throttle.
Well, it's odd that it's funny you should say that, because Ventura just left him in to throw 116 pitches in a game that they were losing 3-1.
So Ventura's been doing that a lot lately, is leaving everybody in as long as it's humanly possible, which is funny because didn't he used to have like a crazy quick trigger on everybody?
Well, I mean, I was looking at Nate Jones again and looking back because, you know, I've been laying Addison Reed and Jones getting their arms slagged by Ventura in 2013 at Ventura's feet, and I've been vocal about that. So I wanted to go back and make sure I wasn't crazy. And yeah, Nate Jones threw 70 plus innings back to back years in his first two seasons in the majors. He threw 78 innings as over 70 appearances in a 99 loss season. Ventura was really excited to get his, he liked his relievers and he wanted to get them in there. I mean, we've seen Ventura overcompensate after a decision burns him in the past. Not always, but we have. I'm thinking the replay, for example, where he didn't use one with two outs in the ninth that one time, and then the next game he used a challenge in, like, the first inning. You know, we've seen him overcompensate. So I don't know after 2014 if he's like, oh, every reliever is terrible, like if he's just traumatized and he just refuses to use them. Because the bullpen's been fine this year. And he's really scared of using them.
Yeah, I guess it's got to be something like that, or you know, he was headed talking to, or you know, I guess just because the guy shows one tendency, you know, in a year, doesn't necessarily mean he can't have his mind changed to some degree.
Well, the White Sox have the fewest innings thrown by their bullpen in the majors.
Which, I mean, considering the overall strength of their rotation, this makes sense.
It does. And if you look at the other teams who've had very few innings from their bullpen, the rest of the bottom five are, in terms of bullpen innings, there are other teams that have really strong rotations, like the Mets, the Dodgers, the Indians, and the Nationals. So, yes, that's definitely a factor. But it does corroborate our impression that he's had a really slow hook this year. Especially, you know, John Danks hasn't been this year, you know, for all that he's a fifth starter where he seems to, he either gets lit up or like has a brilliant game, it feels like.
Yeah, there's definitely very few in between.
So if you could identify when he's going good and when he's not, you would think that it would behoove you to, you know, when he's not doing well, to just be like, all right, John, you don't have it today. We've seen this before. You just don't have it today. You know, there's only a week left before the expanded rosters. Let's get some of the, and you know, he could get some of the, could get guys who need work in there. I mean, this might be an opportunity to get more of a shuttle back and forth from AAA, get some AAA guys some more looks, or maybe you're just waiting until September for that. But it just seems weird. Seems weird that, that this is, seems to be the new look for him, especially with an asset like Rodon, where we keep talking about him, them babying him, and it's just not happening.
Yeah, and that's, I think that Danks theory is something we'll definitely see once the roster is expanded. Because I guess the worry is, well, if we start doing Danks like that, part of his value is just an ability to eat innings at this point, and so
right,
kind of eating into some of his value. But if the bullpen has, you know, 77 guys that they're ready to throw, you can do that a lot more freely.
You could, well, the Rays have really made a thing this year of being really aggressive about shuttling guys back and forth from AAA and getting the bullpen in there as quickly as possible.
Yeah, they have only two guys that they treat like regular pitchers, and everyone else is like, you get five innings and then you're gone.
Right.
No matter how you're doing.
Yeah, and then the other two guys are freaking awesome.
Right.
So it's just, today's a game where, in hindsight and all that, it's really easy to do this. But today's a game where they, you know, they win the game if theoretically they pull Danks up before he gets lit up, has his second disaster inning of the game. You know, you can't know that after the fact. They fell behind 7-1, but they wound up scoring six runs by the end of it. So,
right.
But fortunately, it doesn't really matter if they lose at this point. All right, so we're actually, this is going to go up on August 24th. What do you see changing for the September? Like, what call-ups are you looking for, and how do you see that take, you know, impacting the playing time that's going around right now? Like, obviously, if you're bringing someone up and they're getting at-bats or innings, those are at-bats and innings that aren't going to players that are currently taking them.
So I think the main thing I'd want to see first off is just, like we've kind of been talking about here, with the arms, getting some guys some chances just to throw, just to face some big league hitters. From the offense, from the position player standpoint, I would rather just – there's not anybody I'm terribly intrigued by and ready to see play because I think they're going to be a part of the future at large. But I think this should free up having an extra bench bat or outfielder or two around to not ever lay Adam Roach out to die against the lefty, be very quick about getting, you know, Thompson in there or something like that without worrying about, you know, that place defensively later and things like that.
Yeah, I mean, in terms of specific names, I mean, like, you look in, I know Eric Johnson's obviously a guy I think that we're hoping to see. There isn't too much else sitting at AAA arms-wise that I'm interested in. I mean, we've seen Daniel Webb before. I guess Michael Clato is still chugging away down there.
Yeah, I mean, I was thinking more just from Johnson and Montas' perspective.
Yeah,
And there's always super secret arms. The White Sox tend to have a guy in there that is at least fun to watch throw, because they can kind of rein in a lot of those, you know, heavy speed, no control guys, and kind of get them to, not always, but obviously there's been plenty of failures there, but there's opportunity to see somebody that'll raise your eyebrows a little bit more. I'm not going to expect to get surprised by any position player that comes up in September, I guess is my point.
Well, here's, I mean, so something I mentioned this briefly in passing, but Giovanni Soto.
Heard of him.
Ventura's been very scared to pinch hit with him and use him in matchups like that. We've seen increasingly that the White Sox seem to think that, and there's evidence for it, that pitchers are going to do way better with Flowers and, you know, you're doing, you know, for example, like Rodon, a disservice by having him try to throw to Soto. At the same time, Soto's a guy you got on a minor league deal. He's effective when he's healthy, and he's not healthy very often. You think that's the type of guy you'd be trying to flip to, you know, you think a playoff team could use, like, a backup catcher who can hit. I'm surprised he's still on the roster, and just looking at AAA, you're saying, well, you know, you do still need somebody as a backup catcher. I mean, Rob Brantley is doing fine down there, and he's a guy who, you know, has hit in the majors. He's been a major league player before. What's keeping Soto around?
Yeah, you know, he's had some peaks in at reasonable offense since he kind of cratered out the Cubs a few years ago. But it makes me wonder, because he hasn't been full year terrible since that initial year, I don't think. And it makes me wonder, since he still keeps kind of getting shifted around, if it's not just because, oh, someone could use this backup catcher, and that's, you know, there you go with Texas and Oakland, or if it's like, this guy is not good for the team in general. Maybe there's a reputation behind him.
That's an interesting theory, and obviously we're seeing that the White Sox are sitting here saying, like, look, Flowers glove is just so much better. But at the same time, you know, last year, you saw the wildcard game against the Royals. Oakland had Soto in, and he was keeping the Royals running game somewhat in check.
Hey, look how that turned out.
And then he got injured, and Vogt came in, and then the Royals stole like 8 bases in a row. So as recently as last fall, a smart organization, I mean, granted, we're talking about it versus Stephen Vogt, but a smart organization thought, like, we prefer to have this guy in for defensive reasons.
Yeah, also a smart organization that does things differently. So if it is like but that, then they're one of the teams I'm using as a, you know, they're 33% of the teams I'm talking about that didn't want him. So that kind of ruins my theory. they do things a bit differently than anybody else.
I guess it's just odd that they have a rental catcher who's got an OPS of 825 and the season's pretty much lost and he's just still here.
Yeah, I mean, it could just be chalked up to ineptitude. Maybe Han likes him and Robin refuses, or maybe I feel like it's more like if there was someone that would take him, he'd have been gone in the first place.
Yeah, could be.
And then, but you see, and now we're at the point too where all these players could have already been pulled back off of waivers. He could have already gone and got claimed and got pulled back. We don't even know anymore.
Yeah. And maybe he got claimed and there wasn't a deal to be, you know, because obviously the waiver deals, somebody claims them, you only have that one team to negotiate with.
Right. I think we only find out if somebody decides to talk about it or leak it. I don't think it's like a public matter.
And that's certainly not the White Sox style to talk about that sort of thing after the fact.
Right. So, I mean, they may have tried and there's nothing to do with them. And, I mean, I guess it's, and you need to have a guy around, so it's not worth DFAing. But, I mean, look at Kataris. Like, he's had some offensive bursts, and nobody wants him because his defense is just that bad. But you're right. True. Soto's shown to have an aptitude at some point for that. It was not always been, you know, a problem.
Yeah, it's not. You know, and that's why I talked about his time with Oakland, where it's not a Kataris situation where the entire, all of Major League Baseball has decided this guy can't play catcher in the majors. You know, this is a guy who, as recently as last year, was the go-to option for a playoff team. And after a year of really good hitting, I mean, granted, in limited time, with some of these playoff teams with abysmal options at catcher, it's just strange, very strange. But catcher is a weird position in terms of things that aren't, don't really show up as measurables that seem to be much more important than we might be able to observe from the outside.
So players that get traded past the waiver deadline, because I think it's already a little bit weird to be traded as a catcher mid-season, just because, I mean, obviously it's happened with Soto a number of times, but it's, I guess it's kind of like getting traded in the football season. Like, you need to know so much of the program already. You need to know so much about how everybody's going about things. You need to know your pitchers and everything like that. So I feel like even that extra month lost, so now you're talking August 31st, you have, like, no adjustment period for these guys.
Well, fortunately, Soto's already played with all these teams, so. No, point. I don't want to belabor the point too much. It's just that's one of the few wrinkles about the team, and part of it helps to talk it through with someone sensible such as yourself to try to figure out some sort of direction for this team or some sort of external value that was added for the future during the course of this season. Because you don't like taking a season and being like, well, geez, what was the point of this?
Well, Hans also strikes me as a guy that's not, if he's the deal he wants isn't there, he's probably, unless, it's probably just like, forget it. And with the waiver deals, you only have that one shot, like you said. So, you know, if he didn't get anything for him, he's just kind of like, well, we need an extra catcher, so whatever. It's not like we're going to bring anything back.
Well, and Soto's cheap enough that he was almost certainly claimed by somebody, I would assume.
If he was put up, yeah, I'd have to think so too. But I mean, I'm thinking like, I mean, he did it with Beckham. He just said, well, whatever the fuck you can give us, just we'll take it.
well, right. I mean, but that's like Beckham was like actually throwing out garbage though. Like this.
Right. He provided no actual utility to the team at the time, whereas Soto actually, it's worth him being on the bench. But he's not getting used, like you said. I mean, he's barely getting out there.
In terms of one last, it's getting up there in time. Two things I kind of want to have one last question for you, your opinion in terms of the long term, because that seems to be the phase of the season that we're at this point, you know, evaluating for moving forward. Avisail Garcia's had a good week. He walked three games in a row at one point. But he's still Avisail Garcia. I mean, is there any scenario where he's not the starting right fielder to begin next season? I guess that's the first thing I'd ask.
I don't see the White Sox giving that up. I would like for him not to be, but that's more, I'm just not confident in his abilities. But we have him. He is young. I don't, And if they don't have any immediate replacement, I don't see why they wouldn't just give it a shot. He'd be worth something to trade away, though. Like, if we went ahead and watched the White Sox sign, like, Upton or Hayward or something like that, Garcia is young enough then and has shown enough glimpses that a team might be willing to, you know, give something in return. And then maybe you, that's how you get a third baseman or something like that.
Yeah, you trade him to Detroit and watch him. They'll just J.D. Martinez him. Well, I suppose Detroit's already given up on him once. So, yeah, I...
Although, you know, that may have been some outside forces, if you believe any of what you hear.
I don't. I believe nothing. Abseil is a pretty good metaphor for this season, where it's like there's enough here where it'd be disheartening to try to give up on it, but it's probably not going to work. So yeah, that's the thing to me, is just that the upgrade at that spot looks so easy to me. That it's like, okay, like, let's say you've got $100 million that you can spend on a free agent. I'd much rather have Jason Hayward than Jeff Samardzija, for example. If that's, and maybe that's a false dichotomy, because maybe that's not the choice that they're making.
Yeah, I mean, I'm with you on that, and definitely, because, I mean, I have loved Jason Hayward since before he even sniffed the big leagues. But I also, as a brief aside, I'm pretty confident in the White Sox ruining his ability. Which his unfound ability. I mean, he's never quite hit the potential. I mean, he's been perfectly fine and a usable player, but the White Sox aren't going to be the ones that bring it out of him. In all likelihood, anyway.
I'm just hoping he remembers enough from what the Cardinals taught him that just have it stay with him if the White Sox pick him up. Yeah, you're right. But this line of logic of, and I've seen this a lot, this happened a lot around the draft time, where it was like, well, what's the point of drafting a position player? They'll just break him anyway. It's like, well, if we're there, then why are they even trying to compete? Like, if that's influencing their decision making, then why have you not fired everybody? You know, if you've already conceded that we just cannot put a bat into this environment and have it work, then you need to burn everything down and just start from the ground up again, because you're acknowledging that you're half of the equation is broken irretrievably. Granted, you know, points well taken about Hayward being a project in a lot of ways, you know, a guy who's flashed pretty much every single aspect of an amazing offensive game, but never put it all together.
Yeah.
And had some, you know, his power collapse at, you know, at odd phases of his career. I also really want to compare, because Hayward is still so much younger than people realize. Oh yeah, okay, so Abseil's still
yeah.
Too younger than Hayward, but
I mean, he did come up when he was 19, but yeah, it's been a while. 2010, right? Was that his debut?
Didn't he hit off of Carlos Zambrano or something like
he
that?
He hit at least one home run on opening day off of Zambrano, but I think then the next year he hit on opening day as well, which might be while you're bridging those together.
Yeah, 2010.
Yeah, he's been around.
Oh, his rookie year was so good. in terms of bats that have worked out and certainly come around, where's Jose Abreu going to finish the year? Are his numbers going to get right back to? Is he going to sneak him back up at the end there?
He's in the process of that, isn't he? I mean, he's been like quietly like, oh, I'll just, you know, he had a little streak of a couple weeks where he hit a few home runs, and now he's just squeezing one over the wall every now and again. I mean, he's up to 856 here, OPS.
863 after today.
After today, so yeah, I mean, he's crawling it up there. I don't know if he'll get to 900, but he'll have to keep doing what he's doing. He'll get there. He's not attempting to steal this year, huh?
Yeah, he wants to keep that 75% success rate that he had last year. Just keep that base running wins above replacement component right there.
He scored for first on that that game winner.
Oh, jeez, yeah.
That looked like that was the end of Jose Abreu.
So yeah, and in an effort of trying to keep things positive, as because I know that's not my instinct with this team. And certainly, and I'll even splash Ventura with some positivity here, is for all that this season is like, looks like this big lost opportunity and has been really painful and embarrassing to watch, they still seem like they're having a blast. Like, they all seem to really like each other. I noticed, like, Abreu was doing the, like, goofy, milky hand gestures stuff. I think Alexi was doing some of it also.
Yeah, and that's something we haven't seen in years past. He definitely had. And I think that helps it bearable to watch while we're watching, too. I mean, if they're out there looking like they hate it, I mean, we're going to be a lot more upset while we're watching.
Yeah, and you have the positive thing is that going into 2016 is you have Eaton, Melky, and Abreu who look like they're going to be good again next year. You have every reason to think that they'll be good next year. And they all seem to be, like, really entertaining, amusing guys who seem to really like each other. So at least you have, you know, it's frustrating that it's taken so long. To, you know, the third base has just been this, like, you've just been hemorrhaging value there for forever. And, like, you can't seem to get both corner outfield spots addressed at the same time ever. But they are slowly patching holes. And hopefully they can find a way to get that done before, you know, Sale and Quintana and Abreu start aging out of their primes. Do you even want to talk about LaRoche? Is there anything to say there?
Nothing constructive. Nothing positive enough to walk to the end of this podcast with.
He hit a home run today.
That he did. And he actually has looked somewhat reasonable over the past, this whole road trip, actually, because he's been used sparingly. So this is another thing of Robin Ventura, you know.
5 for 14 in the last four games.
Well,
whatever, that's two home runs.
Again, that's probably what sticks out to me then.
Two home runs, two doubles. But you were sorry about Ventura?
You know, if he's holding him back and only using him, you know, maybe he's learning. He's only going to put him in against a righty late if he's not playing. And basically not just hang him out to dry like he did him a lot of this year when he was looking awful against lefties or, you know, the way Connor died.
Oh, rest in peace. Yeah, and the thing is, with them playing more competently in the second half and stretches than they did for, you know, entire months in the first half, there have been some close games and some close games in the last week. And I swear, Ventura, just his in-game management is just so terrible. It's just so bad. It's like all the worst elements of conventional wisdom and then like random fugue states where he's going to, quote, get creative. And it's like the worst idea in the world. But
I'll be interested to see what happens with him after the season ends. He did make the decision to go year to year, did he not? Or not at least sign an extension as manager?
I would say manager contracts is a huge area of ignorance for me.
I'm pretty sure he turned down, you know, getting extended, which a lot of managers just go year to year period. I know La Russa did it for his entire damn career after he got fired from a certain team.
to keeping with Ventura's consistent position that he didn't want to do this job.
Yeah, and, you know, keep yourself an out at all times. And, I mean, he's looking at a team that underachieved like crazy. So from both ends, that might cause him to be like, well, that's enough. Or for the team to say that's enough. I could see either one just saying, thank you, but we'll see you later.
Yeah, the thing is, if I'm receptive to the argument that, hey, look, this team was so bad, and they could have just quit, and they didn't, and they look like they're still trying real hard, and it looks like they still are enjoying themselves. Isn't that an impressive demonstration of, you know, keeping a positive work environment in the face of very frustrating circumstances? Yeah, that's true. And yes, his in-game management is freaking abysmal, but theoretically that's something you could improve. Like, that's just X's and O's. Like, hey, in this situation, stop intentionally walking the guy. Like, all right, cool, good.
Well, you know what's been the most encouraging thing ever as far as managers in game managing is what Pittsburgh was able to talk Clint Hurdle into.
Yeah.
He's a different manager than he was with the Rockies. And I mean, just completely, he I'm sure he's the same person. He has runs his clubhouse the same way, and that's probably what they saw in him and the reason they tried to, you know, get him to adhere to more of their philosophies. But he took to those, and he runs the team differently.
Hurdle's a great example for how you can learn these things, but at the same time, I think Hurdle is a guy who really wants to be a manager, lost a managing job, and realized that he needed to do something to keep doing the job he wants to do, which none of those things seem to describe Ventura, because
he doesn't necessarily want to be here.
No, exactly, but it can be done. My only concern, though, is that, like, well, part of the reason why, you know, like, okay, well, we've got chronic underperformance everywhere. We have horrible defense. We have horrible base running. Those are typically, you know, right or wrong. Those are things that are laid at the feet of the manager. So it's so hard to know. But I do – the fact that this team's probably going to finish with more wins than it did last year again is – I think it's probably Ventura's job if he wants it. I don't know how great an idea that is, because if they do have a team that's a fringe contender, I think his in-game tactics are enough to tip them away from success. But
also, if they don't have somebody kind of locked in as who they want for a replacement, it also probably – they don't want to put on a full-on manhunt and then end up just taking whoever the best candidate happens to be at the time. They, you know what I mean?
What's Razor Shines doing these days?
Yeah. Here's something – that would be interesting, and I think the only way that this would happen is the only way that Dave Martinez would jump off of the Cubs ship and take a managerial job is if the Cubs win the World Series this year and he accomplishes what he wants to with Joe Madden.
Yeah.
And that would free up Dave Martinez to be the manager.
What about Rick Renteria? Didn't people really like him? Wasn't the only reason they got rid of him was for Joe Madden?
Yeah. I don't know. Everyone, you know, said he was a good guy and everything. I'm not able to call anything to mind as far as in-game management or philosophies or things that he said. But, yeah, everyone said, oh, such a great guy.
For a second, when you said, you started saying, I can't call to mind, I thought you meant I can't call him up. I was like, what? I wasn't asking you to call Rick Renteria to have on the show. I mean, that'd be cool.
He's busy right now. Between the hours of 8 and 9, he told me not to bother him.
Oh, that's understandable. But given that it is not 8 to 9 here, I really need to get moving.
Yeah, all right. So let's call it one.
And, yeah, man. Always fun talking baseball with you.
Thanks for chatting.
Of course.